The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Have the changes in the banking industry affected you? With the looming possibility that your local bank branch might disappear and more web, mobile, and social technologies, what will the changes mean for you and your business? Welcome to Breaking Banks with your host, Brett King. The possibility that banking is no longer a place you go, but just something that you do, has become very real. Now, here is Brett King.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks, guys. Another week, another disruption, another hot topic. It's good to see you guys all supporting the show. We had a big month last month in terms of listenership, so we continue to grow. Thank you for that. And very excited this week. I managed to get Breaking Banks, the book, out and launched. And we launched on Amazon Kindle, not quite out in hardcover yet, but we launched on Amazon Kindle. And as of today, Breaking Banks is tracking at number 2 on the bestsellers list for books in banking. So thank you all for your support. Of course, some of the interviews that we had on the first season of Breaking Banks ended up in the book, along with a couple of other interviews. And I really think that this is becoming a really interesting catalyst for discussion around some of the strong disruptions taking place. So I wanted to look at something a little different this week. We haven't discussed this topic on the show before, but it is an area where I think it affects a large portion of the world, and that is Islamic finance. So I brought onto the show an old pal of mine. His name is David Vickery. And David and I used to work together at Deloitte many, many moons ago. And David now heads up, what's your formal title at NCF, David?
Executive Officer of INCIEF, which is the International Center for Education and Islamic Finance. So effectively, I'm the Vice Chancellor of a university now.
Right, but you've been a practitioner before, of course. You were right in the industry, involved with many of the largest financial service organizations around the world. So what got you interested in Islamic finance?
Well, it started probably over 20 years ago when I found myself in Malaysia working at a local bank on a project through my re-engineering company. And I was invited to take a look at how that bank could open an Islamic window. So my interest started probably 20 years ago or more. And that sort of rolled into the time I was at Deloitte when I started getting more and more engaged in advising banks on how to convert from doing conventional business to Islamic business. And I then, for my sins, which are many, wound up as a managing director of an Islamic bank, which I started from scratch. And I enjoyed that so much, I went and set up another one. And then returned to Deloitte and again got engaged in advising banks in this area and structuring transactions. And I had the privilege about 5 years ago to help China set up its first Islamic bank.
So the bank that you set up in Malaysia was Hong Leong?
Hong Leong Islamic Bank, yes.
And what was the one in China?
The one in China was Ningxia, which is in Outer Mongolia, where the Hui people, who are Muslim. It's an unknown fact that China has an enormous Muslim population, probably in excess of 100 million.
Wow. And INCIEF is based in Malaysia, correct?
That's correct. It's based in Kuala Lumpur. It was established just over 8 years ago with a grant from the Central Bank of Malaysia with an objective to establish postgraduate education. We offer master's and PhD degrees to provide an increased level of human capital for a rapidly growing industry around the world. And today we have over 2,500 students in more than 80 countries around the world.
Now, you're in Washington this week. You've been meeting with the World Bank. Tell us about the collaboration that's going on between NCF and the World Bank, and also NCF and some other institutions around the world.
Yes, certainly. I mean, the World Bank is a relationship we've had for more than 2 years. Effectively, we provide a variety of research initiatives in Islamic finance to support the World Bank, as well as do executive training for them. Last year, whilst visiting Washington, we addressed most of world leadership at an IMF spring meeting, where we demonstrated the effect of Islamic finance on global economic development. And I'm very pleased on this trip that we're furthering our relationship with the World Bank through exchange of our PhD students to do secondments at the World Bank in their headquarters here in Washington, as well as in their new Islamic finance headquarters in Istanbul. And the World Bank has also requested INSEF to help broker a relationship with the British government, who are now very, very focused on developing Islamic finance in their country and the City of London, where, again, we'll be engaged in executive programs, research and development for the industry.
So apart from the close to 2 billion Muslims in the world that obviously may be attracted to Islamic finance, what's the attraction for someone like the British government or World Bank in terms of support for Islamic finance generally?
Well, I think both of those questions. The British government, it's effectively about business. It's simply about London maintaining its leadership in the global market. And I think the Prime Minister, David Cameron, when he announced at the World Islamic Economic Forum in October last year, which was held in London, the first time the forum's been held outside of a Muslim country, his announcement was quite clear that in order to maintain global leadership as a financial center, London and the UK had to embrace Islamic finance. From the point of view of the World Bank, it's very much about how Islamic finance can be used to be mobilized as effectively as possible for global poverty alleviation and economic development.
Okay. So you spend a lot of the time on the road.
I do.
Where are you seeing the more interesting innovations in Islamic finance, not just from a product perspective, but where are we seeing some technology being deployed here where it creates some interesting new approaches to this, which is certainly, from a finance perspective, is steeped in a lot of history, but where are we seeing the innovations in Islamic finance?
Well, I think the innovation, I think, is in two main areas, but I'll focus on two main areas. But I think there are many areas where there is innovation going on. One is in Africa, where Islamic finance is being used as a vehicle to assist in poverty alleviation. So you see Islamic finance backing microfinance and SMEs. And the vehicles which are being used is that it's being done largely outside of the banks and through local operatives, but using payment networks. And I'm thinking in Kenya, particularly of M-Pesa, where banks aren't engaged, but the money is being shipped around because everybody has a mobile phone. And Islamic finance is helping to facilitate the growth and development of not only the economy, but helping people come out of poverty. I think the other area where I'm seeing a huge amount of growth and investment in technology is in the education field for Islamic finance. And this is, using MOOCs, massive operating systems, which effectively provide education for people.
The massive online online colleges, yeah?
Online colleges and so on, where there is a huge demand to not only understand more about the subject, but to get professional qualifications. And this is really, stimulated. I mean, I can use INSEF as an example. 3 years ago when I took up this appointment, we had about half the number of students we have, and most of them were on-site on campus. Now 60% of our students are all over the world and, coming into us through using technology. And of course the cost of education has been reduced significantly, and the operational efficiency is so good now that it's almost as good as being face to face.
And I think that's an interesting element of the Islamic finance constructs, is there's a lot of social responsibility built into, sort of the embedded principles in Islamic finance, isn't there?
Yes, very much so. Overall, the sense of responsibility in terms of not only doing business, but doing business for the good of all humanity is a very strong driver here. So it's not only about trade, doing business, but it's recirculating the profits that are made from business through charitable donations, which is an obligation, through specific donations, and also through the granting of trusts. This is in Islam is called wakaf, but wakaf is effectively a charitable endowment. And the profits from this business, many people are now turning to deploying the money in permanent trusts, which go towards helping with education, poverty alleviation, and so on. In fact, I've just been at a conference here in D.C. where already in the Islamic world, more than $1 billion every month are raised and put into these trust funds for what I call philanthropic purposes. And that is growing at a phenomenal rate every year in double-digit growth.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because the Islamic finance has some fairly specific rules also in respect to investment. But you're seeing an alignment with sort of the social needs, investment causes. And when you've got things like microfinance, it seems like a match made in heaven to some extent for investors to come in and invest in these. Which we would have thought in the past that microfinance would have been risky. But, Grameen Bank showed us actually that it was fairly low risk, especially if you manage it at the community level properly. So there seems to be quite a tight, there's a really, really exciting opportunity here.
Well, certainly there is, and I think that it's growing and it's being leveraged. And I think in the post-crisis world, what is also encouraging and developing participatory finance or Islamic finance is an increasing realization that there's a need to get back to the real economy. And by the real economy, I mean real things, building real things, creating jobs, creating infrastructure where there's an underlying asset, rather than the financial economy, which is very much what I would call paper speculation. In the United States, every year about $33 trillion are traded in the U.S. capital market. But of that $33 trillion, less than 1% actually goes into capital formation for the benefit of the real economy. More than 99% of it is put into what I would call speculative paper trades, which, as we know very well, brought the world to its knees 6 or 7 years ago.
So it's interesting, isn't it, that it seems like there's a lot tighter correlation. There's not so many steps. You can't invest in a fund that invests in another fund that invests in a financial instrument. There seems to be more a direct input of capital into the projects that give some benefit with Islamic finance.
Very much so. I mean, the focus of Islamic finance is on the real economy, so there must be an underlying asset. And it's for the good of the community. If you ask me to come up with a phrase to describe Islamic finance, it is about the efficient and effective mobilization of capital for the benefit of the real economy. And this is something, which is simple and quite pure, and it's for the benefit of all humanity. It's not just for Muslims. Islamic finance is available for everyone, and indeed, in Malaysia, which is a Muslim-majority country, it may be interesting for listeners to note that the majority of takers of Islamic finance are non-Muslims. In the bank I ran, it was 80% because they were of Chinese origin, simply because it was a better deal and more transparent.
Yeah, very interesting. Very interesting. So tell me a little bit about the from a technology perspective. Which of the Islamic banks or those dealing with Islamic products do you think are probably the most advanced in terms of using technology? You mentioned M-Pesa. Yeah. Are there any other examples you can
well,
think of?
Well, I think they're in from country to country. There's quite a bit of innovation going on in financial institutions in Malaysia, where I'm based. You can look at both CIMB Bank and Maybank. are very up in terms of their technology and payments and transfer and products and, you know, mobile technology to assist with customers basically never having to go near a bank or a bank branch. In the Gulf, adaptation of technology, because the investment has been made there and starting from a different base, and you're familiar with, you know, the way things have grown significantly in Dubai, and I believe one of your later guests will probably be able to describe more of what's happening there. A great deal of work is done, you know, online. There's been huge innovations in country to country to use, you know, technology just to open accounts quickly. I mean, for example, in Malaysia, I have a chipped national identity card. I just have to feed that into a machine, and, you know, 10 seconds later, my bank account is open because all the reference data regarding, you know, me, my background, and so on is contained in my national identity card chip. And you can issue, a checkbook or credit card or debit card or whatever it is within seconds.
So in terms of, just for those who aren't familiar with Islamic finance on the show, what are the core differentiations between Islamic finance and traditional or conventional, let's call it Western finance?
Well, I think there are two, although many would argue there are more. But in order to keep it simple, I think the two main differences are that Islamic finance does not deal in interest. It deals in profit sharing, and interest is effectively a rent on money. So Islamic finance does not believe in, you know, using money for money's sake. There must be a trade, or there must be an underlying deal or asset to every transaction. So it believes in profit sharing. And the second aspect of Islamic finance is different, is that it very much encourages, you know, equity participation. In other words, risk sharing. So it's not just a case of, you know, you put your money in the bank and you get an interest rate on it. You put your money in the bank and it's invested, and you share in the profits of that investment, and it's distributed in accordance with a contract which says we will share profit 50-50 or 60-40. Those are the fundamental differences. And what I think is also interesting is that if you go back in history to, you know, the origins of the Abrahamic religion, so Judaism and Christianity, they were both based on the same as well in the past. So it goes back to a common source that, you know, rent on money, which is interest, is actually not permissible. You actually need to use your money or assets for economic good.
Right. And it appears to be that there's more of a focus on transparency as well, because it's not this, it seems to be a sort of direct correlation between what the cost of an account is and the benefit of an account.
Yes. I mean, this is, you know, this is not only is Islamic tradition, but it's an absolute must that, you know, the transparency of the transaction. It has to be clear that the contract is there. It needs to be well understood by both parties. It needs to be, you know, reinforceable and highly visible. So you don't get any degree of uncertainty. In fact, there's a concept in Islamic finance which disallows any form of uncertainty. Contracts must be there. They must be made between competent people, and there cannot be any major uncertainty on the basis of those contracts. So transparency is absolutely vital. It's an underlying value of Islamic finance, and it's one of the things which actually appeals. Certainly when dealing with non-Muslim customers in Malaysia of predominantly Indian or Chinese origin, what they liked about the transaction, besides the competitive pricing, was the fact that the contracts to support a mortgage or auto financing were much clearer and simpler and easy to, you know, enforce than the conventional contracts.
Well, you know, I'd be really interested in talking about whether there are any startups in the Islamic finance that we should be watching and so forth. But I want to just take a quick break, David, and I want to bring in Osama Arama from Dubai into the chat just after the quick break, and introduce in, you know, what he's doing in the remittances business. So stick with us.
Look forward to it. Thank you.
Great. We'll be right back after this brief break. You're listening to Breaking Banks with Brett King.
comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
Your bank's customers expect comprehensive, convenient, and consistent service when and where they need it. A mobile app is a great start, but with so many devices and operating systems out there, it can be hard to keep up with demand. That's why today's leading banks count on the Kony Multichannel Experience Cloud. With Kony, you can design, develop, and manage multi-channel apps from one integrated platform. Build an app once, and with one click, you can deploy it securely across all digital channels, phones, tablets, desktop, and more. That means more efficient for you and a better experience for your customers. Want to get to market fast? Explore Kony's range of ready-to-run apps, including retail, commercial, and private banking. With features like person-to-person transfers, targeted campaigns, built-in integrations, and cutting-edge compliance, Kony apps provide the framework and flexibility you need to rise above the competition. Go beyond first-generation mobile banking. Visit kony.com/BK to launch your multi-channel strategy. That's KONY.com/BK.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You are listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to breakingbanksradio@gmail.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back. You're with Brett King, and this is Breaking Banks. At this point in the show, we'd like to invite all the way from United Arab Emirates in Dubai at a very early hour of the morning. It's 11. Well, sorry, in the evening. It's 11:30 there, almost in Dubai. Osama Al Rahma, welcome to the show.
Hi, Brett, and hi, Mr. David.
So, Osama, you're the CEO of the Al Fadan Exchange. This is one of the largest foreign exchange and remittance groups in the United Arab Emirates, based out of Dubai. Tell me a bit about the Al Fadan Group and the exchange that you run.
Yes, actually, Al Fadan Exchange is one of the leading exchange houses. And when we say exchange house, we mean this licensed under the central bank remittance companies, which mainly serve the majority of the labor force available within UAE or in the GCC countries. GCC means the Gulf Cooperation Council, which is consisting of six, you know, countries in the Gulf here. We do understand that, you know, these are immigrants who leave their home down here to work, and then they need to send their money back home. And they need kind of institutions which can serve their, you know, needs and in more efficient, speedy way, reliable. Yet it is going through the official banking channels. And just like what David was speaking about, you know, tackling the micro level of these people, where it also enhance, you know, the poverty alleviation, and it make the welfare of the beneficiaries out at their home in a better way. These money are significant to most of the immigrants around the world, not just in this part of the world. The World Bank is issuing reports, and the IMF as well, about the immigrants and remittances, showing, you know, different studies and how this contributes to GDPs of many countries in the world and how it adds value to these economies. We do understand that in some sub-Saharan countries, the immigrants' remittances might, you know, contribute to more than 30% of the GDP of some countries. Take, for example, plus it adds a lot to the foreign currency flow to these countries. For example, yes. India receives more than $70 billion. A Philippines, for example, receives around $22 billion. A country like...
And this is in remittances from remittances overseas from foreign workers.
Yeah. They're on immigrants which are around the world. You know, the main the main country to send money is the United States of America, because it receives a lot of immigrants from all over the world as a workforce. And then, you know, the oil producing countries in the Gulf here coming at the second. Europe also, we have a lot of flow to North Africa, where we have a lot of immigrants from North Africa and Africa in general working in Europe. So when you see the whole, you know, world, you will find this movement of immigrants around the world. Along with it, there is a lot of movement of funds going back home from these immigrants. We have from the United States down to Latin America, to Mexico, and this is well known to all the Americans over there.
So how has technology changed this remittance business in the last few years? Obviously, in the past, you know, things like Western Union and so forth was around. But you know, how has the technology changed this? For let's talk about a Philippine worker who's working as a domestic helper or a maid in Dubai, and they get paid their salary, and they're sending half of their salary back home to their family. How do they do that today?
Well, they have actually different means. Technology, no doubt, added a lot of value toward the speed, the efficiency, the security, and the convenience for both the remitters and the receivers. It made their life more easier. It used to be, just to tell the audience that, you know, what used to be is the normal draft checks where people send it by normal mail. This was 20 years ago. Right. And then the beneficiary would, you know, wait for a week or 2 weeks to receive the draft. And then they have to go all the way down to, you know, if they are living in a rural area or remote area, they have to take transportation and go all the way down in a long journey just to reach to the bank and cash that draft. Today, with the technology, it's totally different. If the bank is nearby to them, which we call it a flash remittance, you know, the credit to the account of the beneficiary is happening in minutes, and it gets credited down there. So there's no comparison between what used to happen, and this all been happening because of the technology. This is one way of making it more easy, you know, to speak about it. In Philippines, it's also the remitter down here can send even to the a mobile wallet directly to the beneficiary in Philippines, where they can use it for cash out or using it in many outlets to pay certain products or services. So that is also a more advanced way of making the services more convenient to both remittance
and how much growth have you seen in the Al Fadan business in the last few years based on sort of this increase in remittances? Was it affected largely by the financial crisis? Has it come back now? You know, what's the status of the growth in the business?
Well, frankly speaking, I mean, we see the, you know, UAE a little bit a more unique country when it comes to the demographic. We have around 90% of the workforce in UAE are immigrants coming down.
90, that is, 90%.
Yeah, 90. And so the remittance here for these people are something essential. It is not something secondary as looking to it, you know, something a must take a place on monthly basis. We also actually participate in what we call it wage protection system. That's another thing we can talk about. But we haven't seen kind of a negative, you know, growth. It's been more growing, and even it is during the financial crisis, it has been growing. But instead of growing like at 8%, it grown at around 6%.
So the growth slowed a little bit.
But the remittance industry has been growing. It is more than $460
billion. $460
billion? Annually, yes, per annum. And this is subject to a growth between 8 to 10% on annual basis. And I think by 2015, it might touch around $500 plus billion. And this is as the World Bank, reports.
What is the role that an organization like Al-Fadan plays in the economy? Apart from the remittances back home for foreign workers, what other services are you providing these foreign workers in the country?
Well, actually, we are part what the latest terminology of what we call financial inclusion. We participate in educating the workers from different education levels, especially the illiterate ones who comes from rural areas, to engage them in using technology, using cards for their salaries, for example. And also,
is this the payroll card?
This is the payroll card, actually, because we are part of the nation wage protection system, what is being called, and the UAE government being awarded by the United Nations for such a scheme. This is kind of a program run by the Central Bank and the Ministry of Labor in the United Arab Emirates, and to ensure that every worker down here gets his salary on time every month.
So I'll just translate that into terms for our listeners, say in the US or Australia or the UK, the payroll card is very similar to what we would call a prepaid debit card here in the United States. So the same basic construct, yeah?
More or less, yes. I mean, in Al-Fardan, we also issue a pure prepaid card, right. But that one is like a closed loop card, you can say, and you can have it as an open loop card, both. But I'm speaking.
Okay, so you might have one that's just for putting the salary on, they can get cash out, but then you have another which is underpinned like with a MasterCard or Visa, is that what you're saying?
That's right, yeah.
Okay. So tell me a bit more about the payroll card and that business.
So the payroll as a system, as a program, I mean, whether it is with cards or it is cash on counter, it's a unique program which other countries are trying to learn, and it secures the wages for all level of workers within UAE.
What was the driving force, Osama, behind the government mandating this? Why was there a big push for these mandatory payroll cards?
Yeah, I mean, it happened that during the financial crisis, the real estate, for example, industry being affected, and some of the contracting companies might be slow in getting their receivables, which affected directly maybe their workers. So in order to ensure that everybody, regardless what's been happening around them, the salaries are something which is essential and it's a right of the worker. So the government took one step forward by having the program, and it is a decree from the cabinet. So it became a mandatory to all companies down here to be part of such a scheme.
Okay, good. So, what do you see going forward as the role of the mobile in these places? Because in the United Arab Emirates, this is an economy where you have one of the highest, if not, I think UAE now has the highest mobile penetration and the highest smartphone penetration in the world. So you're right at the epicenter of the use of this technology. But how do you see the use of the phone affecting your business moving forward?
I am a believer in the mobile payments, Brett and Sloane. We've been speaking a lot about it. Now it's being pushed in a faster way since His Highness the Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum announced the smart government in UAE, and they announced Dubai as a smart city. Simply, they are asking all the government departments to be part of the smartphones applications to provide the services as the order from His Highness that the services has to go to the people, not the people comes to the services within these departments. And the fastest way would be through the mobile phones and smart applications. We see it from our point of view that with any services which is having kind of fees or payments, you will have to you know, add a lot of components to ensure that the ecosystem is complementing each other. So this will speed up and enhance the level of, you know, making the nation e-wallets, which many of the banks now trying to do through the Banking Federation. We are in talk with telcos as well directly, trying to come with a clear strategy about to go how to go forward. And as you have mentioned, you've been mentioning that, yes, the infrastructure and the penetration of phones and smartphones as well in specific are well, you know, famous down here. So that will help a lot to get engaged in the mobile payments.
What mix of your business is sort of, you know, foreign workers versus general other, you know, foreign remittances through foreign workers versus other foreign exchange and other financial services? Can you disclose that?
You mean the percentage? I mean, this contributes to the majority of our core activity are the remittances. But yes, we do serve corporates as well for their forex needs. And we, as you are also aware, and David aware, you know, the UAE and Dubai in specific as a tourist destination, you know, 11 million people visited Dubai, and we had one of the, like a Dubai mall being visited by 75 million people last year, and the Dubai airports being visited by more than 65. It exceeded now the Heathrow. It's been announced last month that, you know, Dubai airport has exceeded, you know, Heathrow airport in the traffic. So
this is you're getting a huge amount of tourism and you know, business coming through Dubai as a hub now.
Yeah, and that these tourists, they would need to change money and to have their forex, you know, changed against, for example, UAE dirhams. On the other side, you have a lot of travelers. You know, Dubai is a business hub and is a main destination for many international companies from around the world. And all these businessmen, and they keep traveling around the world. So they also have needs for forex currencies as well. Plus, we are now becoming beyond that one. Because we have this distribution channels, people can do, you know, mobile top-ups, they can do credit card settlements, they can, you know, buy certain schemes from, you know, from banks, like investment schemes. So the shape of what we do is becoming like a hub for different services where you can step in, do remittances, and also pay for utilities, top up your phone, and do so many other issues.
I see. So just quickly, before we go to a break, have you seen, on the remittance side of the business, have you seen the mobile becoming more involved in that, particularly, you know, the use of the mobile wallet and things like that? Are you seeing a marked adoption of that technology?
Yes, but that depends all about the clarity of the regulation when it comes to the wallets and the use of wallets and the KYC issues. You know, the regulator has to step down and make it more clear. And that, you know, the technology is ready and banks ready. We are ready. We're just waiting for the regulator to come with the clear.
Great. Well, thanks for joining us, Osama. Stick around. After the break, I'd like to talk with you and David where you see this going over the next 5-10 years and how we'll see a bit of the Islamic finance and technology worlds and some of the trends you're seeing in places like the UAE merge and where that's going to take us. So you can stick around with us for a little bit longer.
Yes, sure.
Great, great. So you've been listening to Breaking Banks. We're talking technology, innovations, and finance in the Islamic world. We'll be back right after this break.
Business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
Attend Payments 2014 to meet the forward-thinking leaders and disruptors who are transforming how we pay and get paid. Get a glimpse into the next wave of payments innovations and challenges through fast-paced interactive demonstrations, educational sessions, and a buzzing exhibit hall. Register now at payments.nacha.org. Payments 2014 is presented by NACHA, the Electronic Payments Association, the recognized leader in payment system education. The Payments Conference, transform imagination into strategic innovation. Register today at payments.nacha.org.
Now you don't have to stay linked to your desktop or laptop. Take Voice America on the go and listen anywhere. Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
We're always talking business. Talk to an expert. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
You are listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to breakingbanksradio@gmail.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. You're with Brett King. I'm the host of Breaking Banks, and we're talking innovation is in the Islamic world today. And we have two guests with us, David Vickery with INSEF, and also Sam Al-Rama, the CEO of the Al-Fadan exchange business, one of the largest exchanges in the United Arab Emirates. So before the break, we were talking with Osama about the incredible growth in the remittances business. Generally, obviously, there's been a lot of growth in Dubai, so it's been a center of much trade and finance. I'd like to get both of you now to sort of talk about if we can sort of think through where this is going to go in the next 5 to 10 years and how this technology is going to work. One of the things that I found interesting was a few weeks ago we had a show on financial inclusion, and John Owens, who's a senior policy advisor on financial inclusion for the Alliance for Financial Inclusion, was on, and he said there's already 6 countries in Africa where they have more mobile remittance accounts or more mobile wallets than they do traditional bank accounts. And so when we start talking about the sort of customers that you're dealing with, Osama, or David, when we talk about the underpinnings of microfinance and things like that, we're talking about the potential for a huge amount of growth from an area that is traditionally being unbanked. Would you both say that's fair?
Let me start on that. I'd say it's very fair. Certainly, my recent experience in Africa and also in Indonesia, which has tremendous growth in microfinance, the basis for that growth is technology and using mobile technology. And what is interesting, if I can sort of project out the next 5 or 10 years, which I think is the basis of your question, it's not just about microfinance, but the technology is there to actually pool funds. So in other words, if you've got a family or a loosely connected cooperative, they can leverage the credit balances that they have for the benefit of those who've got debit balances, if you like. So you can do what I call offset accounting and effectively cut out the banks from lending the money through just mobilizing the surplus funds efficiently and effectively, because the technology is there to tell you who's got what.
Right. Osama, what about you? What are your thoughts? I mean, the remittance business has grown incredibly in the last few years, but where do you see the growth for this business in the future?
Well, I believe this growth is going to take a place as it is happening right now, you know, where the majority of immigrants are moving around, especially in Asia and the subcontinent and in the African countries, along with the Latin America. But yes, I totally agree with David. This is actually the more it becomes easier for these people to mobilize the money, the more we can open the doors. We are not just talking about having the money, you know, being mobilized from one place to the other. We are talking about when you use the mobile beyond, you know, the wallet. The wallet can be used today as a saving, you know, account. It can be used as a tool for the education. It can be used as a tool to enhance SMEs, which David's been speaking about. These issues can happen only when we facilitate. Virtual accounts in general is something today, you know, a real, you know, tool for the future. It is something which has to be more clear. And when we speak about financial inclusion, we need to practice the things, I believe, rather than, you know, keep making a lot of theoretical, you know, assumptions. Engagement of these people, and we are talking about today 2.5 billion unbanked people. They do have the right to access the banking channels in order to change their life totally.
Yeah. So this is potentially this is huge. In fact, I've often thought about this: is that if you think about the 60% of the world's population that doesn't have a bank account today, and we see rapid banking of them now through the mobile phone, through mobile payments, or initiatives like GCash and Globe in the Philippines, BCash in Bangladesh, and so forth. You know, these alternative distribution methods or alternative financial services. Do you guys think it's too strong a statement to say that some of the biggest banks in the world of the next decade could be being created right now based on, you know, banking the unbanked?
Let me feel that first. I don't think it's too strong a statement. I think the nature of banking is changing, both from a sort of push side in the sense that a lot of trust has been taken out of the system during the crisis and post-crisis. But more importantly, I think with the new generation of, you know, Gen Y, I guess you call them, being very technology savvy, but also financial inclusion, where, you know, even in places in both East and West Africa where I visit regularly, you know, I'll call them the man on the street who are living in relative poverty, you know, do have access to mobile technology. And in effect, if you can marshal those funds that they have, which are, you know, surplus to requirements, you will see a change in the way banking is done. And this is actually, I think I agree with one of the points Osama was making about remittances. This is going to challenge regulation because it becomes very much more cross-border. Know your customer is going to be a lot tougher to do. And effectively, how do you track what is going on when this is going to be very much a cross-border type of business as opposed to country by country?
Very interesting.
May I add here? Yes, this is a very, very important point, which David has brought just now. And this is part of why we don't see the cross-border remittances through mobile taking place in the speed we want it to happen, because of there's no kind of standardized, you know, clear regulations about how to identify these payments when it comes to the compliance level. There's a lot of doubt between so many stakeholders, the telcos, the central banks, and the banks and the other service providers. We always try to use certain platforms to gather different parties in order to come with kind of one standardized definition. Because, for example, take like India, they have already in place their domestic you know, money transfers through mobile across India, which is one of the largest, you know, in the population. And it can help a lot because they have a lot of rural areas. You have in India alone around 500 million people unbanked, you know, among their own population. And having the domestic mobile payments taking place, it gives them, you know, a better tool. But when it comes for India to receive from abroad, from their own immigrants, which is the largest maybe worldwide, still they don't have it. Clarity on that one.
So it's not a matter of consumer demand here to use the mobile right now or electronic means of transferring or storing, you know, the wallet in the cloud or the wallet on the phone. The real issue appears to be the fact that there is demand for this, but it's not really, they're not up to it in terms of the regulatory environment.
Yeah, you know what is happening, and I would like to hear from David because he goes across as well. What is happening today is that we want one size fits all when it comes to the compliance and the regulation. This cannot happen in reality because in a developed and advanced economies like, you know, the Western countries or in the States, where the identification of people is clearly, you know, done, you cannot compare the same, and the banking system is already there for hundreds of years. We cannot compare the same with, you know, Nigeria, for example, or rural areas in some countries. We want the same standard of compliance which being applied there to be applied all over across. Yeah. And there where we need to stand, we need to customize things that match these particular countries with the level they are having today in order to develop them to reach to the level we are aiming for, you know, but not to apply today what's happening, you know, at the Western side on the countries where they don't have that infrastructure to do it.
I very much agree with you, Osama, that you know, having a one-size-fits-all strategy or regulatory environment is neither acceptable or practicable unless you want to exclude the majority of the world's population from, you know, from coming to the table. And certainly in the, you know, the Millennium Development Goals and the World Bank objectives and everybody's objectives, they're clearly trying to, you know, to move through that. But it is going to put some challenges on the regulatory system to come up with something which adheres to reasonable objectives, but actually can be executed at different levels depending on the status of each economy. You know, what is key here is about mobilizing effectively and efficiently the capital that's available and allowing it to flow freely. And, you know, the regulators are going to have to do quite a bit of work in order to ensure that the regulations they put in place do not disadvantage those countries which are already disadvantaged further.
Mm. But this could be, this is where, you know, we've got a great example with Kenya, with M-Pesa, where the regulators were quite friendly to this, and suddenly within 6 years you have 60% of the economy banked that weren't banked. You know, but through a mobile phone, whereas when you have countries like South Africa who said, no, you must have a bank officer handle the cash in and cash out. You can't have a correspondent merchant doing those transactions. Then, you know, you have a fraction of the inclusion. Where it sort of seems to indicate that actually financial inclusion, it's really about having regulations that are sensitive to ease of use, simplicity, and sort of getting out of the way of some of this stuff. But the regulations have sort of tightened up on AML and KYC so much. Do you think this is going to require a simplification of regulations, Osama?
Well, calling it simplification, I don't know whether we can use this terminology. You know, the core thing is about, you know, compliance is identifying the nature of the person in front of you, the source of the money he's having in his hands, and how this is going to be, you know, the final destination and who's the beneficiary. So what we call it KYCC. You know, in a simple way, in a basic way, this can be achieved by different means. You know, but what is happening today, you know, there is kind of stereotyping things and kind of categorizing, you know, certain countries in the world. Today, we reach to the level instead of developing a better understanding, because this is a common interest for the whole world, you know, to fight, you know, the money laundering and the terrorist financing. This is an objective for all the countries, and they are engaged actually in doing this when they're committed to do it worldwide. And it is also the obligation of all institutions to do. But what's happening today, this kind of a classification we feel, and kind of, you know, a biased way. You know, even we have seen recently, you know, some banks, you know, cutting relationship even with banks in our region, just because they happen that they are in this region. You know, it can't go like this when we speak about financial inclusion.
Yeah,
no, indeed.
With that comment, I mean, I think it's about meeting control or compliance objectives. How you do it is a local issue. You can't prescribe the methodology by which you do it. You can't have a global standard on this. You can have a global standard of control and compliance objectives, but leave it up to, you know, various nations or states to decide how they're going to achieve it in order to make sure that we mobilize this capital and let it flow freely.
All right, gents. Well, listen, we have run out of time. It's been great having you both on. David Vickery from NCF. Keep us informed about what NCF is doing. Thank you for joining the show.
My pleasure.
And Osama Al Rama, the CEO of Al Fadan, thanks for joining us at midnight now from Dubai to talk about some of the innovations occurring in the remittance business and with what you're doing with the Al Fadan Group. Thanks very much, gents. You've been listening to Breaking Banks, and we'll be back with you guys next week. Thanks again.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. We'll explore more changes and challenges next week.